Good evening. Thanks so much for braving the weather here and coming to join us for tonight's event, which is entitled Covert Affairs, Communicating Our Nation's Deepest Secrets. And it's an important evening for us because it's the end of the first week of our winter quarter and the first week that we've had a fellow, a winter quarter fellow here. And Tommy Veeder has been here, and this is his third event. He's had, his fellows ambassadors, one of whom I'll introduce in a moment, there by his side this whole time, and it's been a blast for those fellows ambassadors, for our students, and we want to thank you, Tommy, for taking the time to spend with us here in the heart of our Chicago winter. Now I just want to introduce one of those fellows ambassadors. Like I said, Liz Stark has been with us at the Institute of Politics since she entered as a first year, coming to all of our events, helping out at each as an events ambassador, coming over to the House and, coming to small group gatherings, coming to our larger events. And it's really been wonderful to see that type of enthusiasm on the part of Liz and on the part of other first years. Liz is from Princeton, New Jersey, a New Jerseyite like myself. I'm sure there are comments that you all have right about now about our fine state, majoring in political science and Near Eastern civilizations. So without further ado, to introduce our panelists, please join me in welcoming Liz Stark.
Good evening, and welcome to Covert Affairs, Communicating Our Nation's Deepest Secrets. On the night of May 1st, 2011, the United States military launched a successful raid on Osama bin Laden's compound in Pakistan. This historic event also marked a groundbreaking revolution in the communication of national intelligence. It set a precedent for future national security affairs, such as the Iranian nuclear negotiations and the NSA surveillance programs. The bin Laden operation raised critical questions. What government secrets should be shared? What should be safeguarded? What should the public know? And what does the public have the right to know? Here to discuss this complicated paradox are Tommy Veeder and George Little. Veeder is a current winter fellow at the University of Chicago Institute of Politics. He served as a spokesman for President Barack Obama for more than a decade, starting out as Obama's US Senate spokesman in 2004. He later worked as Obama's press secretary during the Iowa caucuses, and then as the assistant White House press secretary. Most recently, Veeder served as the president's National Security Council spokesman, where he was the media's chief contact on all national and international affairs. George Little is the former assistant to the Secretary of Defense for Public Affairs and the former Pentagon press secretary, where he served as the principal advisor to the Secretary of Defense and as the chief spokesman for the Department of Defense. Previously, Little was Director of Public Affairs at the Central Intelligence Agency. Our moderator, Robert Pape, is the co-director of the Program on International Security Policy, as well as the Director of Graduate Studies in Political Science at the University of Chicago. He has taught foreign affairs and policy at Dartmouth, the United States Air Force, and here at UChicago. We are very excited to hear from two of our nation's foremost experts on political and international communications. Thank you for coming this evening, and please join me in welcoming Tommy Veeder and George Little.
Tonight, I think we have a very special event, and I'm very excited to be part of it. It's exciting because there is probably no more important job that speaks between the government and the public than the spokesman for various parts of the administration. Today, more than ever, democratic governments are under enormous pressure from their publics. They're under enormous pressure when there is breaking news about scandals. They're under enormous pressure when there's breaking news about events that were previously secret, which are now suddenly public. Some of those released by the government, such as the raid on bin Laden. Some of those not released by the government, such as with Snowden. The frontline soldiers who deal with those breaking events, who have to make decisions on a daily basis about where to cut the line between what is secret and should remain secret versus what should be public and made public are these spokesmen. And we have two of the most important here with us today. And so what I'd like to do, if we could, is start by asking you to talk about one of the most important events in the last few years, the raid on bin Laden. You both have some detailed knowledge of those days. And I'd like you to tell us a little bit about, give us a window into that raid, and into some of the bigger issues that we're talking about. I'd like you to use that event to talk a bit about this balance and the balancing act between secrecy and the public's demand to know. And then also, if you would, maybe mention some of the things that are a little more special about your vantage point. NSC versus CIA and so forth, CIA DOD. Just so that we can also, just kind of also learn a little bit more about you as individuals.
I should say, first of all, I want to say thank you to the University of Chicago. It's been an unbelievably fun and rewarding week out here. I've met a lot of brilliant students, graduate students, faculty, staff. It's just been a great experience. I would tell anyone to come to the University of Chicago, I would say do it in the spring. George's perspective on this operation, I think, is a lot more interesting than mine. His starts about 6 months earlier when he, I believe, a lot earlier than mine in terms of knowledge of the bin Laden operation, because he was one of the most trusted people at the CIA and thus was brought into this unbelievably secretive planning process that, you know, these guys rightly knew in advance would be the biggest news story maybe in a decade. And there was enormous work that went into preparing to tell that story, and work done to, you know, for any outcome. I arrived that night, or that afternoon at the White House, after getting a phone call or an email from a colleague of mine, Ben Rhodes, who said, you should really get here right now. And I remember walking in, what's going on? I was watching a Celtics game at my house, I didn't really want to leave. And I walked in, and I walked to Tom Donilon's office, and said, where's everybody? Said, you should really go to the SIT room immediately. And I walked down there, and one of the conference rooms was full of the most senior aides to the president and his cabinet, Secretary Clinton and Panetta and others. And another was full of as much junk food as you've ever seen in your life that had been purchased by the SIT room staff. They went to 7 different pizza places or something like that to make sure that no one knew that there was something up. And I remember seeing George. And we talked through what had happened, and I think George put down a picture on the table of Osama bin Laden with a bullet in his head. And it was a stark image and an enormously important moment, I think, for our country, a cathartic moment for people who had lost someone in 9/11 or the Pentagon or on the planes. And I think the beginning of a process of communicating something that was one of the most secret things, period, in the whole United States government, to the most public event in the snap of a finger. So I think with that, I'll turn it over to George, who knows this a lot better than I do.
I don't know about that, Tommy, but thank you very much. And thank you, Professor Liz, thank you very much. I don't know who that guy was who you introduced. checks in the mail. I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for having me at the University of Chicago. It's an honor and privilege to be here. The bin Laden operation was truly an amazing process. And what I should say at the outset is that it reflected, at the end of the day, justice. It also reflected incredible amounts of work by thousands of people over many years. And I happened to be lucky enough to be part of the tail end of that story. But you had incredible people in the intelligence community and the U.S. military who were pursuing Osama bin Laden for just over a decade. And to see it come to fruition, it was an incredible privilege. The story had a good ending. We found bin Laden and took him off the street and delivered justice. But I have to say that having worked on this with my colleagues at the agency for several months, we weren't quite sure that it was going to be a good ending. And in fact, until that night, we didn't know that he was actually going to be there, that it was actually going to be him. We were worried that it was going to be a fugitive banker or exiled Saudi sheikh or something along those lines. We were really worried about things like that. And so this was a persistent intelligence effort over many months. So I was brought in several months before the actual raid and was told that we might be pursuing Osama bin Laden. I said, really? I said, well, if that's the case and something happens here, it's going to be a big story. And I immediately started to worry because as the circle grew wider, I was concerned that I would get a phone call from the New York Times or Washington Post and it would leak. Luckily, it never did. It was a big surprise. But I started to say early on, I said, look, we're going to have to start preparing for the public disclosure of this operation if and when the president decides to go through with it. We need to set him up well. We need to set up the agency well. We need to set up the military well. So I made the case relatively early on that we needed to start to put together a no-kidding public affairs plan. And I faced a little bit of resistance because this was, in fact, a covert Title 50 operation. And there were some legalities involved with doing public affairs planning. But finally, I got the lawyers to say yes when often they say no. And I embarked on an effort to start to put together a plan. And it was fairly simple. I put together two scenarios. One was for success, and one was for complete and utter failure, however defined. It wasn't him. The operation went south. We have a problem with the Pakistanis. You name it.
They crashed the helicopter.
Exactly. that was a stomach turning moment that day. And I put together at the end of this process a binder of about 66 pages. A draft presidential statement, a storyline of what happened as well as I could possibly do it at that point. An unclassified intelligence story. And again, for success and for failure. And of course, we were hoping that it would be a success. There was a lot of talk about communications and so forth at the agency in case it went south. But in any event, let me just give you a couple of anecdotes. So about 3 days before the raid itself, I went down to meet with Ben Rhodes. And he talked about this and what was coming. And then on the Saturday before the raid, at around 10 or 10:30 in the morning, I went to visit with Ben again. And I had a lock bag full of highly classified information with me and went down to the Secret Service gate just outside the White House. And they didn't have me in the system for whatever reason. So I stood there for 45 minutes punching the lock bag to my chest out of fear that I would be mugged. You know, the Osama bin Laden operation would be discovered on the streets of Washington. So I was there for 45 minutes. I'm not usually a very nervous guy, but I was pretty nervous. Luckily, I eventually got in. And just one of those things, right? Systems break down. And that one of the moments that brought it home for me is how impactful this operation was when I walked into then Director Panetta's operations center. We had one set up at the agency for the operation. And at 1:22 p.m. that day, I just happened to be in the room with him. He got on the video teleconference with Admiral McRaven, who was running the military side of the operation, and he formally transmitted the order to commence the operation. And for me, it really brought it home. All of a sudden, a lot was on the line. The lives of our military men and women who were part of this were on the line. A lot on the line, political and otherwise. So I was there during the operation at the agency and then went down to the White House, saw Tommy and a bunch of other good colleagues, good friends, and stayed there through the president's speech. We did a backgrounder shortly after the president's speech that night. And then around 12:30 or 1 o'clock, I left the White House, and of course the phone was ringing off the hook. And this wasn't for us. I was walking with Panetta and another colleague. there's a lot of construction going on, but the crowds outside the White House were cheering and chanting and so forth. And at that very moment, again, this wasn't for us, they couldn't see us, but the construction, they started chanting, CIA, CIA, CIA. And I turned to Panetta and I said, sir, I don't know whether to smile or run. When large crowds are chanting CIA, usually that's not a good thing. Anyway, and then very public disclosure and discussion of this very classified operation began.
So I'd like to ask a little bit more about operations that succeed and operations that fail, and see how that changes your view on what is released in terms of classified information and maybe what should be released. So in the 91 Gulf War, great success, tremendous amount of classified information freely coming. Almost everybody inside the government and who had any part in any of the various successes we had in the first Gulf War couldn't wait to tell their story. And so they're constantly, there's just an amazing amount of information. And that actually kind of tended to flow with other successes in the 90s until the second month of the Kosovo campaign. And this is something I follow very closely with the air power at the time, and it's really quite stunning. So we had a spokesman, Jamie Shea, and in the first month, he was able to lay out all the targeting charts on a daily basis of, and then after 5 weeks, the thing wasn't going so well, and you know what? The briefings just got thinner and thinner and thinner and thinner. Now, obviously, that's before your time, but you've been through both the OBL raid and then also the Benghazi fiasco. Something that's widely going to be viewed as a success and then widely viewed as something not a success. And I just wonder if you could maybe compare those events and also talk about the different situation with respect to what's revealed in the case of a success versus foreign policy fiasco.
Sure. So I would argue that a lot has been revealed about Benghazi, probably as much if not more than the bin Laden operation. Obviously, part of that was because of hearings and subpoenas and the intelligence report that came out today. I think that, you know, when you're talking about traditional military activity, there is a desire and a precedent and an obligation to disclose as much as you possibly can about what occurred, success or failure, because the American people have a right to know what their military did. They have a right to know what sort of foreign policy decisions are being made in the White House or elsewhere, and how those decisions were made. And I think, you know, for me, on our best days when we were at the White House were when we were able to work on a decision for months and months and months, like the decision to increase troops in Afghanistan in 2009. And then once the president announced that decision, bring people in, walk them through the backstory, help them understand not just what was decided, but why, and the rationale behind it, and the challenges ahead, as well as the reasons we hope for success. And I think when you're able to tell a full story at the beginning of an operation like that, it helps mitigate the coverage that might come at the end, because you need to be honest about setting expectations. With respect to Benghazi, it's a far different challenge because firefights like that are by their nature opaque, and it's hard to know exactly what happened. People have different recollections. This happened with the bin Laden operation as well. It's hard to get information from really far away places in the middle of the night. And I think a lot of the confusion that came from the government's announcements or, you know, background sources in those early days was the result of a good faith effort to get information that proved to be wrong. At the end of the day, I do think that incident was highly politicized. People who normally didn't think or talk much about diplomatic security suddenly were seized with the issue, and it probably had more to do with a presidential campaign coming up than anything else.
Thank you. Very good question. So in our society, and when it comes to the intelligence world and the military, there are twin imperatives. One is openness and one is secrecy, right? And they come into conflict sometimes. I have a bias toward openness. to say as much as you possibly can, whether it's in the intelligence community or in the military. I think that's how our government should operate and how we should be oriented. That's not just because I'm a spokesman. I think that's just where we need to be as a country. But there are some things that need to be secret and remain secret. And I think most Americans appreciate that. And I've seen so much go out the door that really shouldn't. It really puts us all in harm's way, in my view. When sources and methods are revealed, particularly human sources, when operations are dimed out, this puts a lot of people at risk. It puts us at risk, it puts our intelligence professionals at risk, it puts our military men and women at risk. So finding that balance is very difficult. And when I was in the intelligence community, I used to say, look, there's no constituency for us, right? There are not a lot of special interest groups out there defending the CIA. So you have to be a strong advocate when you're the CIA spokesman. And it was a difficult spot, but the way you earn credibility and trust is you have open, honest conversations with the American people generally through the press and say as much as you can about the agency's mission and its activities. Hmm. Now, I would agree with Tommy on Benghazi. I think that most of that is out there now. Mm-hmm. I think that, and it has been regrettably quite politicized. I'm not quite sure why. It's worth remembering that four Americans lost their lives, and maybe there were shortcomings along the way. But one thing that struck me in the months after Benghazi, hopefully the American people appreciate the limits of what we can do. Sometimes bad things happen. Sometimes they can be prevented, and I'm not weighing in one way or the other on Benghazi in that respect. But we don't have an omnipresent military. We can't immediately rush to certain places. We assume risk as a government. Our men and women in the intelligence community and the military and in the State Department, they serve in very tough places, many of them. And they deserve a lot of credit for that choice. And we do as much as we can to protect them. But sometimes risk turns into tragedy.
So one of the most famous instances, and I'll just mention Snowden, in recent memory, is this massive release of information about the extent to which NSA was looking at the metadata of all of our communications. And this is something that really puts really front and center the issue of secrecy versus the public's demand to know, not just because there's a natural tension, but also because there's splits in the public over the demand to know, particularly in this case. So we don't just simply have secrecy versus public demand. We actually have a situation where the public itself is somewhat divided over this, and actually it's possible parts of the government maybe as well. Can you just kind of unpack this kind of complex equation a little bit for us and help us see it from your vantage point?
Yeah, sure. I think that with respect to Mr. Snowden and the documents he revealed, I can completely understand how people who read those initial reports about the metadata collection or programs like PRISM that seem to be a sort of broad brush collection system would be alarming. I think in the early days there was some inaccurate reporting that made it sound like warrantless wiretapping all over again, as opposed to the collection of metadata, which is call from X number to Y number at the following time. And I think that while I don't support the disclosure of those documents, I do think it has started a conversation undeniably, and I think the president's going to give a speech tomorrow where he will take some steps that speak to people's concerns about these programs and the collection of intelligence on American citizens, because that's something, frankly, that we need to constantly watch and course correct on, because I can think that Barack Obama is a trustworthy guy and he's not going to do something wrong, but there could be another president that I don't trust, so trust us is just not a sufficient answer. But then I pick up the paper yesterday and read a story about how in the New York Times, about the way intelligence agencies use certain devices to get into Iranian computers, or you know, countries with nuclear programs to bridge air gaps and to get at you know, Chinese cyber armies. Now, I don't have any personal knowledge of these things, but I think that's extraordinarily damaging, and that's not whistleblowing, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. That is profoundly harming the United States' capability to monitor the nuclear programs or proliferation of countries that have a record and a clear intent to create or sell incredibly dangerous destabilizing weapons. And I think that's unconscionable, and there's no excuse for it. And so I think we need to, when we talk about Snowden, I think there is a tendency to talk about clemency for him or see what he did as somehow heroic. I think those arguments don't make sense when you look at the fact that his disclosures are ongoing. We don't know the extent of what he has or will leak. And until he stops doing what he's doing, the idea that he can get forgiveness for him, I think, is not a reasonable expectation.
I think the Snowden disclosures have done incredible damage, and maybe there is a healthy debate around it, but this shouldn't be the way it unfolds, in my view. This shouldn't have been triggered by this kind of disclosure of information. One thing that a lot of Americans, I think, don't realize is that there's an incredible amount of oversight over the intelligence community. And maybe this is inside the Beltway talk, and maybe that's why it doesn't really resonate. But the United States Congress, the courts, organizations inside the executive branch, there's a lot of oversight over the entire intelligence community right now, to include NSA. This is not NSA run amok. This was done with oversight. This wasn't some TV show with a couple of people deciding to collect a lot of metadata. This was a deliberately established program. So that's one point. Maybe folks like us need to do a better job of telling that oversight story. So this is a WikiLeaks example and not Snowden. But these kinds of revelations tend to have a truly chilling effect on our ability to interact sometimes with foreign countries, including our friends and partners. And that includes through intelligence channels. We do a lot of work with other countries through intelligence relationships. It's usually the defense channel, the diplomatic channel, and the intelligence channel. And that channel has been squeezed as a result of WikiLeaks and the Snowden disclosures. And that's problematic. One example, I was with Secretary Panetta in a meeting with a very senior foreign counterpart, and I was the note taker. There were three or four of us in the room. And this very senior foreign leader turned to me at one point, and it was half joking. He said, "WikiLeaks?" I said, "Okay, I'll put the pen down." Of course, I wasn't going to go out and disclose the conversation, but that's the kind of thing that has a truly chilling effect on our ability to talk candidly with other countries.
Well, and just maybe pick up on the theme of other countries, because most of our conversation has been about a domestic audience, and much of what our public sees is you're speaking to our domestic audience, but actually a big part of your job is speaking to foreign audiences. The Iranian negotiations over the nuclear program, can you talk a little bit about how foreign audiences, how you look at an issue like foreign audiences, especially when there's an ongoing, very sensitive negotiation? There's another element. So now we've been talking about secrecy versus a public's demand to know, but with a negotiation, there's also a strategic element, which is it the case that there's a coordination so that it's not just a public spokesman, but it's public diplomacy in coordination with other efforts behind the scenes?
Absolutely. I think the Iran talks is a great example of something where there's enormous need for coordination. So you have six countries negotiating with Iran, the need for secrecy, both not because it's in the U.S. interest or there's any problem, I think, if the American people knew a lot about what was being discussed with Iran, but I think that hardliners and hardline factions in Iran don't want these talks to succeed for a variety of reasons. And when news of these talks leaks out, they can often use it against the negotiators and the moderates who are doing this in good faith and scuttle the talks. And so that's why it was frankly pretty remarkable that we were able to get so far in this line of effort to prevent it from coming out fully and prevent the talks from being successful. To your point about communicating with foreign audiences, it's something the president was seized with when he came into office. And he sent a number of direct messages to the Iranian people. For example, he delivered a Nowruz message to the people of Iran, which I think was an important way to signal respect for them, appreciation for their culture, and recognition of the fact that it is a great country that has some not so great leaders at the moment, but we see the long game in our, you know, in our care and interest is with the Iranian people over the next decade.
You want to add on that?
Tommy covered it pretty well.
So I want to just take a few more minutes, and then we'll open it up to questions for the audience. I want to ask a more put it in a more personal context. So have there been times when there has been a personal dilemma for you with the issue of what to reveal with what not to reveal, where your bosses wanted to reveal and you didn't want to, or the other way around, where there are some personal situations where you found yourself somewhat at odds with your own professional job?
Want to name names?
Tommy and I once went at Go ahead.
No, I mean, I think, so no, not really. I think for me, there were times where I felt like it was inevitable that something was going to come out and we should just talk about it, but people would sort of, who didn't. George and I lived at this intersection of policy and the press and politics and the rubber meets the road. And sometimes the policy people would give you an argument or a line to say in response to a question that just wasn't going to cut it or was sort of not reflecting the reality of the fact that this thing was going to come out. That happened often. And the good thing for us is we could push back and say, come on, guys, I know you live in a secure information facility all day long and like rarely see the sun, but there's this thing called the internet, Twitter, you know, we gotta reflect reality here. There were times, I think, when I was asked to try to sort of keep something out of a paper because I was told that it would be enormously damaging if it were to be reported, and then it was reported, and the sun rose the next day and birds were chirping and everything was fine. And I would sort of go to those people and say, you just took my credibility from here to here. How does this happen? We cannot go to outlets lightly and ask them to withhold information. I think people took that on board, and the very few times we did ask journalists to not publish things, I found them to be more often than not reasonable and responsible and willing to talk.
Especially with bad news, I lived by two sayings. One is, bad news, unlike fine red wine, doesn't get better with age. You got to get it out there. Because saying number two, Churchill, if you're going to go through hell, keep on going. And that's what you have to do, I think, especially with bad news. You just got to get it out there and grip it, acknowledge it, talk about what you're doing to remedy the situation and move on. I think if you try to sit on things too long, if you try to parse and add nuance and get too many people into the equation, then you lose the ability to be authentic. So I obviously wanted to collect the right facts so that I was sharing the right information. I didn't want to go to the podium too quickly. But I was often arguing to, let's just get this done. Let's make sure we tell the story. We owe it to the American people, even if it's a tough slog for us.
You know, and I remember one of the Pardon me for doing
that. No, it's good.
One of the most thoughtful and successful communications efforts I saw in national security was one George led that people were skeptical of, and he talked everyone into doing this, and it was a brilliant idea, which was to take. It,
go on.
he's gonna have to pay more money.
Sorry. Right,
which was to take these videos and footage of Osama bin Laden that we found in his compound. That showed him not to be a bold, brave leader of a cause, but to be a pathetic, sad, ridiculous little man who watched himself on TV and like couldn't figure out how to use the remote. And George did this unbelievable press conference one Saturday morning at the Pentagon. And, you know, I was told that you could hear reporters' jaws dropping as they played this footage for these people. And I think it was a extraordinarily important effort to undercut the image that Al-Qaeda wants around the globe.
Brilliant. There are a number of students at Chicago who I'm sure look at you and they say, you know, especially someone 33, maybe they could become you. And there are people who follow in your footsteps, but you've been there, you've learned. What is the one or two things that surprised you that you didn't know, you really didn't know, that you really want to, that you'll tell us?
National security or just the job?
Your life for those couple of years.
So I was a U.S. government spokesman at CIA and DOD for 6.5, nearly 7 years. It's a long time to do that, probably too long. But incredible experience. And one thing that I wasn't sure was going to happen was that I was going to be read into things and brought into the fold. But if you're not given information, if you're brought in at the last second and don't have the context, then you can't possibly be a good spokesperson and a good communicator. So what I decided very deliberately early on in my communications career in the government was that I was going to be a strategic advisor first to my principal. I worked for 2 CIA directors and 2 secretaries of defense, and a communicator second, so that I would have a seat at the table. I would be able to have influence over decisions, not just communications calls, but other decisions being made by the agency or by DOD. And I tried to learn as much as I could early on so that I could explain it later. So that was one takeaway for me.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point. Sometimes there's a sense that people who talk to the press therefore must tell them things they shouldn't, which always was bizarre to me because, you know, you don't see a lot of janitors like throwing stuff all over the ground that they then get to clean up, which is sort of the analogy, I think, for us. But yeah, I mean, if you go out sort of half-cocked and say something that's wrong or inaccurate, or you speculate, I guess one of the lessons I learned is there's no margin for error. You don't get the benefit of the doubt if you guess. You're seen as a liar. And it's an important thing to remember for anyone that's doing these jobs.
Awesome, awesome. Well, what I want to do is turn it over to you folks. Please. Yep. And we have some microphones. I think we have microphones.
I got to say, it's nice to be out of Washington right now.
Hi, thank you. I have a politics-related question for both guests. So, Mr. Vizard, since you worked as a spokesperson for a president and also before for a presidential candidate, how much is politics a factor in your messaging? And then, Mr. Little, I understand that your role is not political, but how much do you need to align your message with the White House, and what happens when there's a disagreement in messaging? Thank you.
Two questions.
Very good.
Obviously, a White House is very overtly political, or I'm sorry, a campaign is overtly political in nature. And, you know, everything is about winning a political campaign. In the White House, certainly politics surrounds the building and is part of everything that's done. I mean, not in a negative way, but in because of the fact that if there's not support for what you're doing, you can't do that. That said, when I was in meetings in the Situation Room on national security, I never heard discussions of politics. It was almost treated like a third rail. It was something that no one would touch because the focus was on the substance of the policy. And that was especially true with intelligence. We wanted to hear from the intelligence professionals that had been doing this work for decades, that were extraordinarily good at it, and not in any way allow a perception that it was influenced somehow by politics.
Very good question. And you're right, at CIA, I couldn't be political at all. It's a non-political organization. Intelligence is intelligence. And you speak truth to power, whoever that is. And at DOD, also a very non-political role for a variety of reasons. not the least of which is that one out of every 100 Americans works for the Department of Defense. I would often remind Secretary Panetta and Hagel that when we were facing tough issues, and I'd get some interesting responses. You know, thanks a lot, George. Maybe more colorfully put, but in any event, in terms of coordination with the White House, Tommy and I would speak frequently. We would to share information, to compare notes, but never in a political way. Yes, it was my job to advocate for the policies of the administration, but that's different than being political. And the Pentagon Press Corps understands that. The Intelligence Community Press Corps understands that. And it would have damaged my credibility had I crossed into that political space, even though I was a political appointee in the Obama administration. So you have to be very careful about what you say. Your credibility is on the line. And it's not just your credibility. If you're the Pentagon Press Secretary and you go out there and say something wrong, it's the institution, it's the administration, it's the secretary, it's the president, and the stakes are high. And I'll be honest with you, one of the reasons that I left, it was a long time, but you're in these jobs for a long time and you buy risk every day. And I hadn't really been dinged up a whole lot, maybe Tommy would disagree. But not that I felt like I was going to get into trouble, but that's one consideration.
So much for coming. So I have a question about WikiLeaks and you know, Snowden. So when WikiLeaks broke, it was kind of like, oh my God, this is horrible. This is the epitome of what terrible, you know, whistleblowing could be like. And then when Snowden came along, it was kind of like, well, crap, this is even worse, right? Like, it's international. This is so many repercussions. So how do you think, you know, you as spokespeople or the government in general, international governments, how, kind of given previous experiences with whistleblowers, do you think going forward situations like this can be controlled immediately, faster? How can they be prevented in general? Should there be more disclosure kind of right off the bat? You know, I mean, both of you said sort of like inevitably it will come crashing down and someone will find out. So how do you think, like, where's that boundary between the two?
My theory of the case is that anything that the intelligence community does in a classified setting or the military does in a classified setting will eventually come out, whether it's tomorrow, next week, next year, 10 years down the road. So you better figure out whether or not you're ready to talk about it publicly. And I would often ask folks at CIA, for instance, okay, we're going to do this little thing. It's interesting, it's lawful, probably work, but do you want it splashed on the front page of the Washington Post in a few weeks or in a few months or a few years? Everything gets out now. It's the unfortunate reality that we live in. And maybe that sounds jaded, but I think that is the reality that we're living in. And I think I would encourage my colleagues in the Defense Department and in the intelligence world to think about how they're going to talk about their programs once they do come out. Yeah. You have to be able to defend them.
That's a very, yeah, I totally agree with that. I left before Snowden happened, and I'm very grateful for that. But I remember when the New York Times brought the WikiLeaks disclosures to us. They asked for a meeting with me and a colleague named Ben Rhodes. We went and we sat down, and we spent a couple hours with a bunch of their reporters who plopped down a big binder and walked us through all the horrific things they were going to report. And we walked out and kind of laughed because we couldn't think how we possibly were going to manage this. And looking back, I'm incredibly grateful to the New York Times for the way they systematically worked through mitigation steps, removing names of individuals and cables filled by the Taliban or others, sort of being understanding about things that spoke to sources and methods like George mentioned earlier. But remember, these were documents classified at the secret no foreign level, which is damaging, but not enormously damaging. The Snowden disclosures are some of the most secret things we do. Precisely sources and methods. This chip helps us get this information. And so I can't even imagine how you can deal with a situation like that because you don't even necessarily know everything they have. In fact, I know they don't. So I think George's point is right on. we shouldn't think that anything can be done in a vacuum that won't eventually one day come out, and not the 25-year time frame envisioned by classification rules, but a lot faster. I also think there will likely be more debate in the intelligence community about this, these concepts of the need to know versus the need to share, because after 9/11 there was a lot of great work done, and George was there at the inception of this, to stand up places like NCTC to ensure coordination and sharing of intelligence, and then to push that information forward to warfighters, people making policy decisions, whomever. There's a constant balance between who gets read in on stuff, and unfortunately this incident might have the result of pulling back information from people who probably need it.
Hold on, this just a...
does member of the family have a question calling in?
I think it's Snowden. just to build on this a little bit, because I mentioned to you both before, I'm interested in your views on how you see journalists today.
Oh, yeah.
But in the 1980s, Jonathan...
I have a view.
Well, in the 1980s, Jonathan Pollard was the big spy. It's probably before this audience generation, but they'll Google and they'll find Jonathan Pollard. And they'll also find in the late 1980s that he revealed secrets to Israel about some of her most sensitive communications efforts. One of those was Ivy Bells, which was efforts by our submarines to tap into cables that the Soviet military were using. And no one knew about this at the time. The New York Times agreed not to publish those details. Bob Woodward wrote a big piece in the Washington Post, this was before he became very cooperative, where he just revealed everything about Ivy Bells, and so suddenly people like me know about the details of this. And in the first Gulf War, there was, as I was joking with you, if you watch the SNL skits you can find on YouTube, you'll see that there's a very deep adversarial relationship between the media and government spokesman. So I'm just wondering if you could tell us your views on how you see the journalists today. I see them as far more cooperative than in the 80s or even in the 90s today with you folks. But how do you view journalists? Cooperative, adversarial, mix in between?
So I can't compare them per se. The great thing about going from a campaign to a White House environment was you went from a voice on the phone to someone in the room. They could literally walk into my office and I could walk into theirs, and you interact face to face. I think on the campaign at times there was bravado and chest thumping, and you know, people fought for the sake of fighting. And then when you see someone face to face, you realize they have a 5-year-old that's sick, and you know, they're a human being. And so it was better and more cooperative in terms of being collegial. I by no means viewed it as cooperative per se. I think there was a lot of really tough, dogged, adversarial journalists, people like Jake Tapper, who's now at CNN, a whole number of others that would just go after you all day long, every day. And I think, unfortunately, the White House had sometimes manifested itself into theater at the White House briefings. Mm. Which is silly and a waste of time and posturing. But I think that journalists aren't looking to do administrations any favors as a general matter. I think certainly there's a need for access and interviews, but they want to dig up mud and dirt, and they're very good at it.
I was firewalled from a lot of the political dimensions of reporting, so I was fortunate in that respect. I was also fortunate at the Pentagon, for instance, with a press corps that simply wanted to be informed. Very professional press corps. I would hold press conferences sometimes, but I would also hold what I would nickname professor conferences. You just go out there and you try to educate a little bit about what we're doing, what we're thinking, this, that, or the other activity, and so forth and so on. I don't think that it's a sport of long season when you're a government spokesman. And you can't go in every day looking to bash, you know, reporters. It doesn't work in your favor. I think it's important to develop professional relationships with reporters. When there are moments of friction and tension, you hash those disagreements out professionally when you can. I had a flare up or two, sure, but I tried to maintain my composure most of the time because you're going to be working on the next story with them. And sometimes you're going to need to negotiate. And I did my fair share of negotiations with any number of media outlets on trying to suppress stories altogether or to shave out some specifics in terms of the details on, in other stories. And if you're confrontational all the time, I don't think it really helps the case very much. So that, maybe that's just my personality and style. I would go toe-to-toe on occasion with reporters, and it can be there can be adversarial moments, but I don't think you should walk into the job thinking, all right, I'm going to have a dogfight every day with the New York Times.
Right. Yes, sir.
When the Bin Laden announcement was made, the networks went on the air live, and then they sat there for like a couple of hours, and during that time, it became known what had happened. So by the time the president made the announcement, everybody knew the basic fact he was going to say. Why was there this long, dead period when all the networks were live and just sitting there, and then the fact came out during that period?
I think the short answer is congressional notifications and conversations with foreign partners.
Yeah,
I think that's and also drafting the president's remarks.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way. So, I mean, we felt an obligation, the administration did, to inform Congress, give them a heads up what happened, and then to call people like, the Prime Minister or President of Pakistan. That was, I think, the reason for the delay. A lot came out all of a sudden on the networks, too.
Yes.
Yeah, right? I mean, we were sitting there. We didn't have cell phones, so it couldn't have been us. We were in the Situation Room watching things leak already.
So. Hello. My question is about the craft of acting as a spokesperson. And it strikes me that there's a particular bind. On the one hand, you have to craft messages that anticipate responses and perhaps even tarry them in advance. While on the other hand, you're asked to extemporize, even pushed by journalists in a press corps. And so I was curious what strategies you had to respond to this bind of extemporizing when you can't make mistakes, then also what training prepared you for the job. Thank you.
I had zero media training. It probably shows this very night. But I did grad school. I did my PhD at Georgetown, please forgive me. And then went into consulting for 5 years, 7 years actually, and then was picked up by the government. They were my client at the time, and they wanted me to come in and do some counterterrorism work at the National Counterterrorism Center. And one day I got a call from CIA, and they say, we want you to come be a spokesman for us. And I said, I think you're nuts. I mean, I've never had any kind of communications experience at all. And they said, well, you have a PhD in international relations. We have a press corps that's sophisticated and wants to talk substance with a spokesperson, so we think you might be good for the job. I said, I still think you're nuts. From that night, I said, Bethany, CIA wants me to be a spokesman. And she said, they're nuts. And you're nuts if you take it. And ended up taking the plunge and was there for 4.5 years and then DOD for 2.5. And so zero media training for me. I personally went out to the podium and pretended it was a lectern in Georgetown. That was my personal way of just trying to orient my style. And so that's how I personally approached it. But yeah, zero media training. Sorry, what was the second part of your question, which actually came first, I think?
The strategies you use. Ah,
right. So one quick example, I don't mean to steal your time, Tommy. Every morning I would do what's called gaggle. If I wasn't doing an on-camera briefing, I would gaggle with reporters, merely an off-camera press briefing in my office, which is quite large at the Pentagon. Ridiculously large. I had my own bathroom and shower. It'll never happen again. You get prepped for these gaggles. And you'd be given talking points. Here's what we say on Afghanistan or Iran or Kim Jong-un and Dennis Rodman. I would not try to use the talking points. I would try to say the same things, but in my own voice. because reporters can tell when you're reading from talking points and when you're speaking in a more straightforward manner and you're more authentic. So I tried to be obviously consistent with administration policy and with what the Defense Department was doing, but I would try not to just read the script because they can tell the difference. And so when you bridge to extemporizing and you have to make some calls there at the podium, you're viewed as a little bit more credible, maybe. That was my approach.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, my work was, I never was briefing at the White House podium. I was preparing Jay Carney or Robert Gibbs to do it. And so the way they handled that was, one, they had a team of people to run down questions on issues. So if, let's say, pick up the Dennis Rodman line of effort. So, you know, we read that this morning and we go to our North Korea guys and figure out what to say and what the lines were on Mr. Rodman. And then, you know, when Robert Gibbs would get up to the podium and get press, he would know the president well enough, having been with him and sort of known the subject, the issues, to know that without having talked to him, that he probably thought Dennis Rodman's kind of a moron. This trip was a really bad idea. You know, and so part of it, it's what George was saying, it's from getting off those talking points of just having a sense of what your boss believes, and speaking candidly and in plain language in a way that sounds real.
Yeah.
Great.
Wait 1 second. They want to give you a microphone.
Hi. So I was wondering, both of you have worked.
What's your name?
I'm Eric.
Eric.
both of you have worked in spokesperson capacity for various security services and obviously have a lot of information from there. And without maybe doing anything that would get you in trouble, what is maybe one threat that is maybe out there but people don't really focus on, hopefully not the same one from both of you, but just something that if someone was interested in looking up something to kind of look into, what do you think is one kind of threat?
What's your favorite threat stream?
I'll go first.
Okay.
Yeah. you'll have to be more creative.
I know.
Well, look, cyber's in the news today, right? And it's only recently become a major headline, not just because of NSA and so forth, but I really am concerned about the cyber threat. I am concerned that we don't have our arms fully around what could happen to us. A cyber attack could bring down our financial system, our banking system, our electrical grids. It's serious business. And we're having a big debate in Washington right now about what the definition of cyber is, what's defensive versus offensive cyber operations, what are the legalities, and so forth and so on. And meanwhile, others are playing against us. And I think we're losing airspeed and altitude to some extent. Secretary Bennett used to say that he was concerned about the cyber equivalent of Pearl Harbor. And
I tend to agree with him. I do agree with him.
Didn't write that line, but. And I do think that the cyber threat is something that we as Americans haven't quite gotten our arms around yet.
It's a very good one. I thought of that.
So I think that some of the threats in the Middle East, like places like Syria and Iraq, and the sort of metastasizing of Al Qaeda or other extremist groups in that region, is fairly well known. I think that less well known is the structural problems in northern and western Africa that could lead to, and I guess eastern Africa too, if you think of Al-Shabaab or Boko Haram or other sort of Al-Qaeda franchises that are moving across that region. And there's not a quick fix. You can't drone your way out of a problem, and the president doesn't think we should. It is a long, decades-long process of governance and capacity building and development, because when you have 50% unemployment with young males and they have nothing else to do, nothing to turn to, they are far more likely to embrace sort of a nihilistic worldview. And we should remember when we talk about cutting foreign aid or retreating from somebody, that there are consequences. And remember that, you know, the most important tools in our toolkit to fight terrorism, kinetic. It's not killing people. It's these long-term efforts done by USAID and the State Department and NGOs
in these regions, and we need to support that work.
This side, please.
I just wanted to ask a question about something that Professor Pate had touched on earlier when he was speaking about Iran, which is that when you are talking to the American public, you're also speaking to an international audience. So in terms of the bin Laden raid, how were you planning on balancing the reaction that you would receive from the international community and from Pakistan specifically? And in general, how do you keep the balance between bolstering domestic spirits and keeping the international community on the same page?
Sure.
Sure.
Good question.
Very good question. It was something we thought about long and hard about, especially with respect to Pakistan. We were going to go into their country without them knowing and take out
someone in a relatively
populated city in Pakistan.
We wouldn't
like that if the other country did it. the Canadians.
or the Pakistan.
Any Canadians in the audience? those pesky Manitobans. There were a lot of thought went around that, and that was done inside the agency, the White House, the State Department, small group of people who knew at the State Department, and we weren't quite sure how the Pakistanis would react, quite frankly.
And we were concerned that we would actually get into a shooting war with the Pakistanis during the operation, potentially. We just didn't know.
And so managing that was unpredictable to some extent, but we knew they were the first foreign country we called. That happened. I watched Admiral Mullen reach out to his counterpart, General Kahani, of the Pakistani military that night in the Situation Room. So that was call number one. We thought we ought to give them a heads up. And so there was a bit of a choreography, but it couldn't be totally scripted, right? Because events were unfolding in real time.
Yeah, to George's point, the initial reaction was fairly muted, actually. Day one, day two, I remember thinking, wow, this is going surprisingly well, famous last words. And I think political recriminations, a sense of just humiliation among the military, especially the lower level, bubbled up and came out in the statements of leadership.
And we were in a rough patch anyway with the Pakistanis.
Yeah.
We'd been in a series of events that occurred that really had taken the relationship to new lows, and we were about to go into
create some more tension
with the line operation, but at the end of the day,
obviously, we thought it was right that we do to go in and deliver justice.
Sir.
Hi, thanks for coming in and speaking with us tonight. As people who are entrusted with a lot of the classified and top secret information, how do you deal with having all that knowledge in your heads when you're not discussing that with other people who have security clearance?
You know that, you know, Men in Black, that like stick? No, there are definitely times where you...
No, tomorrow we're going after bin Laden.
There are definitely times where you would pause and think, how do I know this? I think there's a little bit of discipline. There's a healthy caution about erring on the side of not getting into things that are too sensitive. It is a privilege to have access to that information and to work in the government. I took that very, very seriously. And I know that George and the people at the agency, they have colleagues and friends in the field, in dangerous places. They're putting their lives at risk every day to get this information. And when you, I think, are immersed in the stakes of what's involved, the idea of disclosing something just because you can or because you think it's cool is...
it's unheard of, absurd to me.
It's a great burden in many respects. A great privilege, a great burden to have this access.
Very careful.
So my mental trigger for staying out of trouble was just when a national security issue came up, all right, what are the top lines?
unclassified, and if it goes any further, then just go to a different kind of conversation. My personal strategy around the bin Laden operation. Now, my wife had been used to me saying I can't talk about that, so there had been a pattern, but I was away a lot at the office for several months, and she couldn't know why, and I couldn't tell her. And that weekend, we were having friends over, and there was a White House Correspondents' Dinner the night before. Luckily, Leon Panetta had been nominated to become Secretary of Defense 3 or so days before the bin Laden raid. I couldn't figure out why. A lot going on then. and that gave me an out, a truthful out. I said, Bethany, I need to go in this weekend to help the director with his confirmation process. So you have to gotta be very careful.
Yeah, that's a great story. I mean, it's also just a reminder of the you can imagine that. You can't tell your wife, your family, your friends what you do or what you're working on. I was talking to someone George worked with at the agency, he's a very senior individual. I was at a party, and I met his wife for the first time. And I said, thank you so much for letting Michael come. And, you know, I know we never let him leave the sit room. I know that must be really difficult. And she said, let me tell you a funny story. So, the day of the bin Laden operation, she told him, look, you haven't been around in a while, but our daughter's recital is this night, and you better be there. And he said, I don't know, I'll try. And it's like, as like the trigger is getting pulled, you know, it's like Edelweiss's thing. And she said she's sitting in the auditorium and checking her watch, and it starts and he's not there.
She's thinking, what would a divorce attorney cost?
You know, that's challenging. And then later that night, he was finally able to call her and say, turn on the TV. There it is. The sacrifice is worth it.
This is how a CIA officer's dinner conversation goes at home. It's, you know, Bethany, I was working with, well, can't name her, can't say the name, but we're working on this thing.
Really neat.
And it was really hard, and I can't talk about it. So, you know, you got to be somewhat cryptic at times.
I think we can get a couple more in. Yes, please.
This CIA officer, by the way, not agent. Agent is someone we recruit. I try to educate. You know, so see, FBI special agent, CIA officer.
Yeah. Thank you for the semantic note.
That's yeah. I've got more where that came from. If you like it,
Professor.
That's all the value I've added today.
Thank you guys so much for coming. I have a question about when you're giving a press conference or when after preparing, you know, Jay Carney or whoever for a press conference, has there ever been a time when there was a question that just totally blindsided you? And if so, first of all, can you tell us what it was? And second of all, what does the process look like when you come off stage? Like, once the press conference ends, what do you do about that issue?
When you're totally blindsided by a question at the podium, the worst thing you can do is to try to give an answer that you don't know the answer to. And so you just say, I don't know. But the day after the first Obama-Romney presidential debate, I got a pretty off-the-wall question about Sesame Street because of Governor Romney's comments about Big Bird and the DOD's relationship with Sesame Street and so forth and so on. And I could feel myself going into very dangerous territory. So all I could think to say was, look, I'm not going to answer that question. I don't want to ruffle any feathers.
Brilliant. Brilliant.
I remember that. There's a big loop of file
chain. I'm trying to think. I feel like I was blindsided every day. You know, like, let me get back to you. But what was particularly stunning early on was the degree of focus on administration. Like, you're like the hot new thing and the toy. And I remember a friend of mine, a colleague, was working on rolling out the story of Bo the dog, and it had leaked. And this reporter
so did Bo
lost. Reporter lost her mind, or his mind, excuse me, was the editor, lost his mind at the Bothus dog story leaked and was saying the most brutally cruel, awful things to this colleague of mine. And I just wanted, you know, it was one of those moments where you just step back and like, it's a goddamn dog. Relax. So I know that's not your question, but.
Can I borrow a minute or two just to
go right ahead.
So one of the worst mistakes I ever made as a spokesman revolved around Leon Panetta's dog, Bravo. Bravo was a frequent visitor to the CIA and to DOD. The first time I met him was at the CIA holiday party in December of 2010. Bravo was around, by the way, for the Bin Laden operation. and the director was walking Bravo out the front door to take him on his walk, and of course reporters are the last to leave a party where there's alcohol. So one of them asked me, well, what breed is Bravo? And I said, well, I need to check. And I went up to his office and consulted with his executive assistant, and we both agreed that Bravo looked a hell of a lot like an Irish Setter. So I told the Washington Post this, and they reported that Bravo was an Irish Setter. Well, the next morning, it was reported, the director saw it, and at the senior staff meeting, he looked down the table at me and said, George, I just want to have you, Bravo was actually a golden retriever. And Bravo means a lot to Leon Panetta and to the Panetta family. And I shrunk in my seat, you know, because I was getting the stare. And so a couple weeks later, I felt bold enough to try to joke about this. So I said at the same meeting, 8:30 in the morning, sir, I'd like to give you actually Bravo a Christmas gift. And I'd gotten Bravo a doggy t-shirt that said, hello, my name is Bravo, and I'm working undercover as an Irish Setter. I'm sorry, I'm digressing here. It doesn't end there, though, because fast forward, next year, at the DOD holiday party, Bravo's there, same drill, reporter comes up, different one, and says, what breed is Bravo? I said, believe me, Bravo is a golden retriever. And I wake up the next morning, and Politico reports that Bravo is an Irish Setter. And I called the reporter up immediately, knowing the consequences of this, and demanded a correction. I said, well, why did you think he was an Irish Setter? And he said, because I fact-checked the Washington Post last year.
I can see why there are always so many only so many holes in the body you can say.
Yeah, right.
Well, let's thank these two great guys, because we've learned a lot.